He said he wanted some more money to fund another trip, and guess what? She gave it to him.
He went back again.
So he started out again. But this time he went on faith. And he didn't have that special sailor because he knew it was round and not flat. And you understand how Bill whittles away at our notion that we got to have faith, because Columbus didn't have faith. All he had was a simple suspicion that the world was round and not flat. And imagine all the progress that's been made because he had that suspicion. So what he says to you and I is, if you're locked up on the idea that you got to have faith that you think some of these other people you know had that you've heard about over the radio or TV or you've read about, then get off of it, because all you got to have is belief.
You got to process
change.
Okay. What we're going to do is, I'd like to tell you that we invented this, but Columbus used it, and it's a formula for change that has been used ever since the world began. And it happens with everything, no matter how little or how insignificant. And the process is this. I have to be willing to change, number one.
Columbus was willing to attack this thing head on and not sit around with perceptions and fettered ideas and fixed ideas tying him up. So he was willing to change.
He was willing, and the prospect of getting all these riches from the East Indies helped him with his willingness, because he felt like he could get there quicker and get back earlier. All right, you have to believe you can change.
Columbus believed that he could change. That's all he did now, just had a suspicion.
Okay, you have to make a decision based on the belief.
Went to the King of Portugal and the Queen of Spain, got some money, put his things together, headed west to get east.
And then you got to take action based on the decision.
That's what he did when he was headed west to get east.
Okay, now, you know, this formula for change works with everything. If I get up in the morning at my house and I'm sitting there drinking coffee and I don't have my paper, you know what happens for me to get my paper? I have to be willing to change the fact that I don't have my paper. I have to believe that I can do something about this. I make a decision to go get my paper, and then I take action. You know, I walk down to the mailbox and I get my paper and I come back, and now I'm sitting here drinking my coffee and I'm reading my paper and having a good leisurely morning. The results, we get, always the results come as the result of action taken. See, when Columbus came to believe, he was still standing on the banks of the Mediterranean over there. When he made his decision, he hadn't turned a peg. He was still standing right where he was. It wasn't until he started taking action on the decisions based on the belief that things began to happen and change began to occur. And this is the process for change that occurs with everything. Okay?
So the AA program, you see, is not a novel idea, because it's the same idea. It's the same idea that Columbus had. Our circumstances make us willing to change, don't they? We believe we can change. We make a decision based on that belief, step 3. We take action based on that decision, step 4 through 11, and we get results, step 12. How do I know that? Because step 12 says I get results. The first third of step 12 says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. Then I have faith. Then I have some of these other things that I thought it was necessary for me to have before I could make a beginning. I didn't need that to make a beginning. All I needed to do was have belief that I didn't have to be the way I was any longer.
Okay. He said, we ask ourselves this. Are not some of us just as biased and unreasonable about the realm of the spirit as were the ancients about the realm of the material? Even in the present century, now this is no longer correct because we're in the 21st century now. He said, even in the present century, American newspapers were afraid to print an account of the Wright brothers' first successful flight at Kitty Hawk. Had not all efforts at flight failed before? Did not Professor Langley's flying machine go to the bottom of the Potomac River? Was it not true that the best mathematical minds had proved that man can never fly? had not people said God had reserved this privilege to the birds?
Again, he's using an example here because he says, well, is proof important? Should I have proof? And he's telling us an example here where proof didn't make any difference. The Wright brothers were a couple of them, were no relatives of mine, incidentally. I wish they were. Maybe that would be materially beneficial to me. It hasn't been. But they were attacking something which prejudice and superstition and fixed ideas had stopped, because nobody had been successful in flying, and so they said flying is for the birds. And everybody had failed at it. But these two guys were willing to change and believed that they could change. And they didn't have any trust or proof or faith. They believed they can change. So they made a decision based on that belief. They were bicycle mechanics. They were high school dropouts. But they tried. They built this thing that looked like an airplane, and they tried, and it crashed. And Wilbur told them, Orville, see, I told you this thing crashed. So they said, let's scrap it. And he said, no, let's make another one. They made another one. And finally they made one, and they made a flight. And they flew, according to this picture, on the 17th of December 1903. They flew 120 feet for 12 seconds. That's not much. That's not very far, and that's not a long period of time. But because of the process that we talked about, they were able to bring about change, a lot of change, as you and I know. And a newspaper reporter saw him. Now he had proof that you could fly. So he went back, and he did whatever you did back in 1903 to get the word to his newspaper that he had seen the Wright brothers fly 120 feet for 12 seconds. And the newspaper, to show you about superstition and prejudice and fixed ideas, how handicapping there are, even with the proof, would not report the story. So we see here, Bill points out in this particular reference that proof is not necessary. How many of us said if you could just prove God? Well, proof didn't do any good to these guys because they wouldn't print the story even after they had proof. So we know now that faith and trust and proof are not good arguments.
Okay,
against coming to believe.
Do we actually know what flight is? I'll tell you what flight is. Flight is when lift plus thrust exceeds weight plus drag. When that happens, you're flying. Okay. You can take a calculator and an engineer can prove mathematically that a bumblebee cannot fly. Because a bumblebee has a great big old bulbous body and he has little bitty short stubby wings. And mathematically it is impossible for those little bitty wings to generate enough lift and enough thrust to move that body. There's only one little teeny thing that's wrong with this idea. A bumblebee cannot read. He doesn't understand that he can't fly. So he makes a decision based on the belief that he can fly, and he takes action and flies all over the stinking place. You know, so proof doesn't matter. Okay, now we're going to drop back over to 48.
We're going to drop back a little bit now to keep you moving around a little bit. We're going back to page 48.
Okay, middle of the page.
One of the things, now we hope Bill's whittled away at our blockage, our prejudice, superstition, fixed ideas about having to have faith, having to have trust, having to have proof. Bill whittles away at this. All you got to have is belief. But some of us may say, if I just understood God a little better, if I understood God, then I'd be willing to take a chance on him. Well, he's going to talk to us in one paragraph about understanding. On page 48, toward the bottom, two-thirds of the way down the page.
One, it says the practical. He says the practical individual of today is a stickler for facts and results. Nevertheless, the 20th century really readily accepts theories of all kinds, provided they are firmly grounded in fact. We have numerous theories, for example, about electricity. Everyone believes them without a murmur of doubt. Why this ready acceptance? Simply because it's impossible to explain what we see, feel, direct, and use without a reasonable assumption as a starting point.
So he's using electricity as an example of why we don't have to understand God. What he's saying here is, if I use this, he says, okay, you use electricity every day. Now, most of us do not know the ins and outs of the electrical energy system. We probably know that, because we heard it in physics or general science, that if you pass a coil through a magnetic field, you'll generate current. Still some question whether you generate a positive to negative or negative to positive, but you'll generate current. If you run this current through a fine enough wire, it'll heat up, or you can keep them a little apart and it'll flash across and make light. We know that. But if you say, well, how does the power, do I really understand how the power gets available to me to use? And most of us don't know how that happened. We don't understand steam generating plants and hydroelectric and nuclear power plants and distribution system and the things that bring it in to the residence or the place of business like this. Yet we use it every day without question. We go in a room and we flip a switch. And we expect something to happen, don't we? We don't understand it. Huh? We pick up the remote control, we point it toward the television, we go like that, and we expect something to happen. If it doesn't, we get upset. But if somebody said, do you understand what happens so that you can do this? No, we don't understand. Do we? You get in your automobile and you take the ignition in there and you turn it and you expect something to happen. And if it doesn't happen, you're upset. But if somebody said, do you understand fully how come you're able to do that? Then we don't. So you see, Bill whittles away again, and when we say, if I just understood God a little better, he says, nonsense. You use things every day, example electricity, that you don't understand a lot about, and you do it without hesitation. I'm telling you that you can't use the fact that you don't understand God as an obstacle to making a beginning at step 211.
Okay, there's another lesson, I think, to be learned in this paragraph that I discovered by studying this one paragraph over and over. The source of my power today is a company called Duke Energy in Charlotte, North Carolina. And if you want to help people and you want to find the correct way to help, this other book that you find around in meetings where we go to from time to time, I read that. And there, we had a teacher a couple of thousand years ago that used to help people. And I would go back and I would look at the manner in which he helped people. And he never did everything for people. He only did the things for them that they could not do. He would always leave them something to do in order to finish the project that they had started together. There was a saying once that a blind man came to him. And he spat in the dirt and made clay and put it on his eyes. And then he told the man, said, go wash in the pool of Siloam. He gave him something to do. Now the clay was on his eyes and he had done everything that he was going to do. And you know what? The man could not see a lick. And the reason he could not see is he had not yet fulfilled his part. Once he went and he washed in the pool as he was instructed to, then he could see and everything was fine. But this healer and this teacher always left us something to do. Well, now Duke Energy treats me basically the same way. I have a good relationship with Duke Energy. When I go home from this study, I'm hoping I can walk in the back door and flip the switch. My light will come on. You know, the thermostat works. The microwave does like I want it to. The whole nine yards. But Duke Energy requests, because of our relationship, that I have something to do. They said, now, if you would, just every month, send us a little check in appreciation of how much you enjoy our services. And I do that. And as a consequence, we do real well. But if I were to go home and I would get something turned crossways and I would make the decision, I'm not going to have anything to do with Duke Energy for 5 or 6 months. They have irritated me and I'm don't think they're doing right, and I'm not going to have anything to do with them. After about a month or two of my not fulfilling my portion of our arrangement, what do you think would happen if I walked in my door and flipped the switch?
Lack of power would be your dilemma.
You got it. Why would I be willing to believe that I would be any better off ignoring my responsibility to my spiritual power as I would to my earthly power? Why do I think I would be any better off when I choose not to fulfill my portion? If I turn my back on the source of my physical power, I mean my spiritual power, I'm going to be in the same shape that I would be if I turned my back on Duke. Because I have something that I have to fulfill in order for this to happen. Our portion of our program of recovery is not so all-inclusive that we do not have to participate. We have to do our part. Okay. We're going to page 55.
So you see what he's done here? I hope that he's, in Bill's manner of teaching, he's whittled away at those notions that he knew we'd have, those ideas and the arguments that we'd have against making understanding the need for a power greater than human power in the solution of step two. He whittled away that we don't need faith, we don't need trust, proof doesn't make any difference, we don't have to understand God, all we have to do is believe or be willing to believe to make a beginning. And that does, as Jerry said, lower the down payment. So now we have a procedure, a basic little kindergarten formula which will permit me to begin to make some progress in my relationship with this power greater than human power. But then we ask the question, where is the power? So that's where we start to read on page 55, first paragraph. Yet he says we've seen another kind of flight, a spiritual liberation from this world, people who rose above their problems. They said God made these things possible and we only smiled. We'd seen spiritual release but liked to tell ourselves that it wasn't true. What he's saying here that we have in our lifetime heard about people and read about people who have risen above difficulties with spiritual tools. Yet we kind of chuckled and we kind of laughed at them. And we didn't really believe that that was true. He says, actually, we were fooling ourselves. He said, we had seen spiritually, but like I tell ourselves, it wasn't true. Actually, we were fooling ourselves. For deep down in every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a God was a part of our makeup just as much as the feeling we had for a friend. Sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but He, capital H, was there. He was as much a fact as we were. We found that the great reality, capital G, capital R, deep down within us, in the last analysis, is only there that He may be found. It was so with us. So what he's saying is that deep down in every one of us is as far as we got to go. We got to reach down in there in the basic fundamental concept of God. And we know this. We know this because we've known right from wrong. We know right from wrong, so we know that there's some sort of fundamental concept of right within us. I've never done anything wrong and I didn't know I was doing wrong when I started it. I knew it every time. I'd have that little voice say, you better not do that. And I'd go ahead and do it anyway. And I'd get into all sorts of trouble. You know that. So that subconscious thing has been there all the time. We've all experienced it. But Bill says that's within me. Now, if it dwells within me, I got my own personal God. It's not Baptist, not Methodist, not Roman Catholic, it's not Hindu, it's not whatever. Not his, not hers, not yours. It's mine. simple little kindergarten idea of where I can find God, deep down within me. Now, this is a new God for us, and it's nobody else's, and I have a new understanding of Him. Remember that I asked you to underline in Appendix 2 that phrase, tapped an unsuspected inner resource of strength which I presently identify with my own conception of a power greater than ourselves. That's where Bill in Appendix 2 refers again to that inner resource. He doesn't tell me to look for the God of my grandmothers, my grandparents, or the preachers, or these things. He gives me permission to look down inside myself where God really is and to build on my own conception of God, my own personal God. No way I can make a decision with my old ideas of Him. No way I can make a decision with somebody else's interpretation of who God is. So this little chapter, chapter 4, We Agnostics, has told me a lot of things. Other volumes and books would be over my head, but this little chapter has told me that I needed the power, that to start to find the power, all I had to do was believe, a procedure to follow to find the power, get rid of the old ideas, fixed ideas and superstitions, and He told me where the power was, deep down inside me. What could be more simple? Did not in any way try to prove God to me. It showed me a way to find Him so He could prove Himself to me. This is the most simple procedure known in the world today. Most of the writings and the things that we might go to find out some information about this are too complicated for us. And this is a simple little procedure contained in a few pages of chapter 4, which have done these things. That I needed the power, how to find the power, and where the power was. Is. What could be more simple? Now we've laid a foundation for chapter 5, how it works. You know, we get the misconception sometimes because we read how it works a lot that the meat of the program is in chapter 5. But you see why we can't start people at chapter 5? Golly, we've taken a long time to get there, haven't we? There's an awful lot of information necessary before I can get to how it works in chapter 5. Had to go through and understand the problem. Lack of power. Had to thoroughly understand the solution power. Now I have to lay out a program to find the power. To see how to recover. Now this was a prolonged process with Bill. And the 40 original drunks between Cleveland and Akron and New York City who began to put together this book after the November 1937 meeting, group conscience meeting. We have trouble making decisions. Can you imagine the trouble they had back then trying to agree on what was going to go in this book? Between the geographic difference? Joe McQuaney said it took his group 4 hours to decide whether to put in a Coke or a Pepsi machine. Can you imagine all the conflict that there was? Bill was doing the writing. He was sending it all over the place, and they were editing it, sending it back. He or Nell Wing or Ruth Hawk, his secretary, would type the revisions, and they'd send them back on until they got everybody's approval. And they finally got everybody to approve with everything up through chapter 4. Amazing process. How do we alcoholics ever pull that off? So now he gets to chapter 5, which Bill understood was a very, very important part, because now he dealt with the problem, now he dealt with the solution, and now he had to deal with the process to find the power, to how to recover. And he knew it was important to bridge between step 2 and what had to be done in step 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. And he felt inadequate. He felt inadequate to do this. He said he knew that he had the 6 ideas of the Oxford groups as a basis, but he knew that they needed expanding because he knew that they had loopholes in them that we alcoholics would find a jump through. He wanted to close those up. He found that there were some that weren't adequate, that he needed more than what the Oxford group ideas were. Needed expanding. He said he went upstairs when he got ready to write the portion of that we read how it works in meetings, that he went upstairs He wanted to write that, but he felt inadequate and he was tired, so he laid the pad and the pencil down and he lay down on the bed and he took a little nap. And he got up and he prayed that God would help him be led into writing this important part of the program. He said he picked up the pencil and it seemed like the pencil had a mind of its own, and he began writing. And in a very short period of time, he had written that portion of chapter 5 that we read in meetings down through the ABCs. And he felt that was God's will because he prayed for it, and he felt like the pencil had a mind of its own and that God had really written them. And that included the steps, which he didn't number until after he finished with the ABCs. Then he went back and numbered them, and it came up with 12. And he felt that that number had some credibility. And he related it to the 12 apostles. And he says, 12 has some credibility. And we know that night after he'd finished writing this, that a couple of guys came from the Oxford Group meeting. Howard, one of the guys, Horace or Howard, they called him. And guy had been around Oxford Group for a little while, one of Bill's friends. And a new guy, only been sober about a month. And Bill felt excited about this portion that he'd written, and he approached these two guys, and he said, let me show you what I've written here. He says, I feel excited about it. These guys were mad, and they started to argue with him. Now, you can see why, don't you? Because of the 12 proposals, you see. Now, they just come away from a group that only had 6. Now there was 12. If you went back to your home group tomorrow and they had 24, you'd be upset too, wouldn't you? but anyway, this was a pivotal point in writing the book. It's obvious what happened here. There was a lot of argument and discussion before the Akron, Cleveland, and New York City people agreed to how it worked. Jerry's going to read.
Have you got a copy of that? Original manuscript. I gave mine to somebody.
Have you memorized it?
No. No, not yet.
Jerry's going to read. You can follow along in your big book, and you'll see where the changes are. Jerry's going to read the original manuscript that Bill wrote that night. And you'll be able to see from Bill's wording in this original manuscript just how important he felt this particular part of the book was, because he makes some pretty strong points. Later on, they requested that he change some of these because he felt he might run some people off. But here's the original language that Bill wrote that night.
This is what he originally wrote and how it works. He said, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our directions. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a way of life which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. He says, our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to follow directions. At some of these, you may balk. You may think you can find an easier, softer way. We doubt if you can. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that you are dealing with alcohol, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without help, it is too much for you, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. You must find him now. Half measures will avail you nothing. You stand at the turning point. Throw yourself under his protection with and care with complete abandon. Now we think you can take it. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as your program of recovery. Admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care and direction of God as we understood Him. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. We're entirely willing that God remove all these defects of character. Humbly on our knees, ask Him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make complete amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual experience as a result of this course of action, we tried to carry this message to others, especially alcoholics, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. You may exclaim, what an order, I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic.
Doctor's opinion.
The chapter to the agnostic.
Chapter 4.
And our personal adventures before and after.
That's Bill's story and the stories in the back part of the book.
Have been designed to sell you 3 pertinent ideas. A, that you are an alcoholic and cannot manage your own life.
Step 1.
B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism.
Step 2.
And C, that God can and will.
Step 2.
And then he says, if you are not convinced on these vital issues, and that's the ABCs, you ought to reread the book to this point or else throw it away.
Now, it ought to be pretty obvious here with this language what happened with this language. You know, in the early days, they'd visit a guy in jail or in prison or in hospital, and they'd tell their story, and they'd tell him about to try to help him see his powerlessness, and then they'd come back in a few days and tell him about the need for a power greater than human power. And when he got out, they'd take him to an Oxford group meeting and sponsor him, like we sponsor people in fraternities and sororities in that way, not the way we sponsor people in AA. And if the Oxford group accepted him, then they'd take him upstairs and he'd get a chance to get on his knees and make his surrender. And that was his first action in the Oxford group activity, was that action of surrender. So we know that that was the Oxford group's first idea, was to surrender. But it's our third idea. So when they wrote the book, they understood that they couldn't do this, that the book had to do it for them. That's obvious because it says, right after Jerry says what he did, that being convinced we were at step 3. So the book had to do what they normally did by themselves for them. What it says is, when Jerry read, that if you're convinced on these 3 vital issues, A, B, C, then you're ready to take step 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, you're ready to move on. If you're not convinced, then you better reread the book until you are, or throw it away, because you can't take step 3. Period. Pretty simple. Now, can you see how confusing it might be to the newcomer when he thinks the meat of the program's in the 5th step, and all of a sudden he reads after the ABCs being convinced for step 3, and he says, good gracious, where'd 1 and 2 go? So every step from step 3 is going to tell us 3 things from step 3 on. It's going to tell us why we need to work the step, how to work the step, and the results of working the step. It's going to tell us those 3 things. Doesn't tell us that for step 1 and 2, folks. They're not working steps. They're conclusions of the mind based on the information presented to us in the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. I'm powerless. stating a fact based on the information that I learned from the doctor's opinion and Bill's story. Came to believe information I found in chapters 2, 3, and 4. Conclusions of my mind. They're not working steps. I'm stating a conclusion that I've reached based on the information that I have. You understand that? From step 3 on, we begin to move into some action steps. But the first two are conclusions of the mind and not action steps. Can't start folks here because you're asking them to make a decision on something they don't know anything about. One of the things that's pretty clear here in Bill's language is that he did not intend for these to be a set of suggestions, but a set of directions. He said it 3 times. He didn't intend for it to be to us as a group, but to the individual, because he said, you. And the other members, they argued with him, and they said, you can't give directions, and you can't, it'll run them off, and you can't tell them what they must do, because they'll run them off. Tell them what we did, Bill. So after weeks of argument, they compromised, and with the help of a psychologist, his name was Dr. Howard from Montclair, New Jersey, who was a non-alcoholic friend of Bill's, they made a compromise, and Bill gave up, even though he thought it was God's will, what he'd written. So he made 3 basic changes from what he'd written. He changed directions to suggestions. He changed you to we. And he changed must to ought. And the groups felt that more people would probably use the book with this language. We don't know today. They might have been 5 million in AA today if we'd left the original language. We don't know that. Left the little original language, it might have gone busted. We don't know that. But we know where it ended up, exactly what we use today in the first 4 editions of printings of the book. Now, Bill was coming baffling and powerful, too, because he said, okay, I'm going to make these changes, but if I'm to finish the rest of it, you're going to let me do it without being edited. I'm not going to send it back to Akron and Cleveland and go down around the New York City groups and get the thing edited. You're going to have to let me finish it if I make these concessions. And they said, okay, we'll let you do it. They reluctantly did that. So we know that 2 pages later, we'll see that Bill puts directions right back in there. So
that's another thing about knowing how Bill writes. The only chapter in here that contains this easier, softer language is chapter 5. That's the only place that you'll see this, suggestions and stuff. He's going right back to directions and you and must and ought and all of this stuff in just a minute.
Now, Bill could understand. He saw the trouble that the Oxford group approach had with alcoholics recovering. And so he tried to design this, or God did through him, to be a program that was more acceptable and better functioning for the alcoholic. One of the things that Bill felt he needed to change, or that God inspiring him, when I say Bill, remember God's inspiring him because he prayed for God's will. One of the things he felt he needed to change was a strong religious language. First century Christian movement, the Oxford groups, it might be offensive, and it was, because the early people in AA were Northeast industrial, upper middle West industrial, a lot of Italian, Polish, Ukrainian, Roman Catholic, and evangelical religious language in the Oxford groups approach was offensive to some of those. So what he did was he changed that. And step 3, where they said surrender, Bill said make a decision. Step 4, they said examine your sins. Bill said, examine your sins. He said make a searching and fearless moral inventory. Because he knew that we wouldn't be very good examining our sins. We'd examine other people's sins, but not our own. The Oxford group's 3rd idea of sharing and confessing found its way into the 5th step with a little different language, admitted to ourselves, to God, and other human being the exact nature of our wrong. There were no ideas in the Oxford groups like step 6 and 7. God inspiring Bill felt that it would be impossible for you and I to go all the way from the sharing and confessing idea of step 5 to the restitution ideas of steps 8 and 9. that we had to do something to be rid of these things that showed up on the inventory. And so he put in steps 6 and 7, which are new steps. We're entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. The fourth idea of the Oxford groups was that idea of restitution. And it found its way into steps 8 and 9, in two steps, as this thing unfolded. The fifth idea of the Oxford groups was continuance. But Bill thought that God inspired him to think that there was something necessary before we went into continuance. Well, I'm glad he did that, because he put step 10 in there. And that's a brand new idea. It wasn't in the Oxford groups idea. I'm so glad he put that in there, folks, because I think that step 10, my opinion is that it's, you know, Bill says in the 12 and 12, now comes the acid test. Can I stay sober, maintain emotional balance, and live to good purpose in fair weather or in foul weather? Man, I don't know what would happen if I didn't have step 10. If I sponsor you, you need to be a scholar in step 10, don't you, Jerry?
90 and 91 and 12 and 12.
Memorize it, where it starts at the spiritual axiom. I think this is so important that God inspired Bill to put the 10th step in there. I don't know what we'd do without that. And the continuance idea number 5 of the Oxford group, found its way into step 11, that we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God if we understood it. And the 6th idea of the Oxford groups, similar to their theory, which said those who have been changed must change others, found its way into a portion of step 12. So with this, we had steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, and 12. And on top of those, Bill put step 1, the idea of powerlessness, the conclusion. And that he got that from Dr. Silkworth. And step 2, the idea of power, which he got from Ebby, which came from Dr. Carl Jung. Isn't it amazing that the program as it unfolded, the 12-step program that you and I use today, didn't come from one single alcoholic? It came from a neurologist who'd gone busted in a depression, who was heading up the alcoholism program at Charlottetown's Hospital. It came from a psychiatrist, a world-renowned psychiatrist in Switzerland. And it came from a first-century Christian movement, the Oxford Group. Amazing. Okay, we're at the... this is how the 12 steps unfolded, and now we've got a good foundation, and the cornerstones are in place, and we're ready to take a little break and get you some cigarettes and whatever you're going to get.
Oh, yes. Need to do that.
We were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to the care to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by this, and just what do we do?
Now, you ask the question, if you were the reader of the book, and you might ask this question, well, just what do we mean by that, about turning our life over to the care of God, and just what do we do? So he begins to answer that question, because he's going to deal here with selfishness and self-centeredness as the root of our problem, how we must be rid of that.
He says, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success.
I hope you'll underline that sentence. He says, he introduces what he's going to say by this statement. The first requirement, and that's a specific. He doesn't say it's a good idea if. A lot of folks do and it seems to help. Didn't say that. He says the first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And then he tells me what happens.
He said, on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Now, if we're going to get into this area of self-will, we need to do like we did with our little dictionary. We need to agree on the use of some terms. And Dick has some terms up there.
You read them all.
Will and life are simple. A will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. You know, all action is born in thought. Now, we think sometimes that it isn't, but it is. All action is born in thought. Okay, if my mind is in good shape, then I make a decision in my mind and I take action based on that decision, I'm in usually pretty good shape. But if my mind is all messed up, then I have trouble with my actions because the decisions I make and the actions I take are based on faulty information in my mind, and it just really gets terrible. Okay, there's a word decision on there, Dick?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the word decision is up there. Decision, the word itself implies further action. You know, what is that Joe McClaney said about three frogs on a log?
The three frogs were sitting on a log, and one of them decided to jump off. How many were left on the log? Three, because the frog hadn't jumped yet.
He just made
that? Did everybody get that? Oh, did everybody get that? Come on.
Okay, and another little misconception in this area here is that I hear people that come into AA and says, you know, I can't really understand it because I came into AA 6 years ago and said, I turned my will and my life over to the care of God in step three 5 years ago and said, you know, my life is still all screwed up. And I can't understand that. Well, we don't turn our will and our life over to God in step three. What we're doing is we are making a decision to do that. And we're going to find out later on that we have developed some things in our character that blocks us off from God and makes this impossible. If it were possible for us to say, okay, God, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to your care, and that'd be the end of it, that'd be the end of the program. You know, because the thing says, if we find the power will solve our problem. But there are certain things in our makeup that are blocking us off from the power. You know, and once we understand these and be rid of them, then we can follow through with the decision that we're going to make here. But the rest of the program is not doing anything in the world except us to carry through with this decision that we're making in step three. Okay? Let's talk about self-will. There's only two kinds of will in this world, as far as I know. One of them is God's will, and the other is self-will. And I don't think that they work in conjunction with each other. I think normally we're either working on one of them or we're working on the other. Not 50-40 or 60-30 or 70-30 or whatever. It's just we're working on either our will or God's will. And you know, if we're going to talk about self-will, maybe we need to figure out where it comes from. In that same self-help book I was talking about a little while ago, there was a... they said a long time ago, God created this garden, and he wanted some companionship. And said he made humankind in his image. And I don't think he meant in his image as far as his physical appearance or anything like that was concerned. He wanted something in his image that had intelligence, that was capable of understanding and doing things like that. So humankind is godly in that instance. And he put them in his garden, and they were just doing the greatest you have ever seen. The book that I read tells me that these people that were placed in this garden had direct fellowship with God in the cool of the evening. And I think that's what he wants for all of us. And the part of that that I don't have today is what I've deprived myself of by reasons of my actions or my behavior.
Serenity Park.
No food stamps, no nothing. All of our needs were absolutely taken care of.
No law enforcement officers, no highway patrolmen, no speed limits, no nothing. I mean,
no. Everything was perfect in this garden. But Adam and Eve, these two people, had self-will. But they didn't know they had self-will. And they had never exercised it. Until one day, this snake comes sliding up to Eve and said, honey, so what are you doing going along with all this stuff? And Eve said, what are you talking about? He said, all of these things that you have to do, he said, you don't really have to do any of those things. He said, I do. He said, you have self-will. And she said, what's that? And he explained to her what self-will was. He said, you know, I don't have self-will. And says, I have to go along with the program and I have to do what's instincts and nature tell me to do. But says, you don't. You can do it any way you want to. And so he explained to her in depth about self-will, and Eve was real excited about this thing. And she went running and tell Adam and said, oh, honey, said, you're not going to believe this. Said, we got self-will. Said, we can do anything we want to. Said, we can even eat that apple over there if we want to.
God said we shouldn't.
But she said, we can do it. And they made a decision to eat that apple. Now, it was a bad decision.
Don't know why we call it a bad decision. It was the first one they ever made. See, they had never had to make one before.
They didn't have any experience or anything to base it on. They made a terrible decision with the apple. And I have not fully forgiven the snake for this deal yet. You know, I still don't like it.
And we kind of have to look at Eve a little funny, too, ladies.
Maybe she was the first compulsive overeater. I don't know. but anyway, when they started exercising self-will, God kicked them out of Serenity Park. He told them, he said, I love you people and I gave you self-will. And says, if you want to exercise it and you want to look after yourself, then I'm going to let you do that. But says, you can't live in the garden. But says, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to let you keep it and I'm going to let you do whatever with it you would like. But says, if your actions and your self-will get you into so much trouble that you don't feel like you can make it, says, if you will give your will back to me, then I will again control your life and everything will be in reasonably good order. And so that is really the only way that we can be rid of self-will, is we have to give it back to God. Now we're going to have to find out the things in this program that block us off from doing that, from carrying out our decisions. And one of the greatest evidences of self-will that I know of is in the 12 and 12. And it's one of the few things that we use that's not in the big book.
And we use a portion of chapter 4, the first portion of step 4 in the 12 and 12 as a description of what God is going to help us work on here and help us to understand, help me to understand why it's very necessary for me to be rid of self-will. And here's what he says. He says that creation, a capital C that would be, gave us instincts for a purpose. He's going to talk about three basic instincts that God gives us for purpose. He says, without them, we wouldn't be complete human beings. If men and women didn't exert themselves to be secure in their persons, made no effort to harvest food or construct shelter, there would be no survival. He said, if they didn't reproduce, the earth wouldn't be populated. If there was no social instinct, if men and women cared nothing for the society of one another, there'd be no society. So these desires, these instincts for sexual relation, for material and emotional security, and for companionship are perfectly necessary and right and surely God-given. Everybody understand what he says here? Three basic instincts that God gives us to help us function. The social instinct, which helps us mingle with each other, necessitates that we do. Without it, there wouldn't be any family, wouldn't be any fellowship, there wouldn't be any love, wouldn't be any groups. The material and emotional security instinct, without it, we wouldn't do anything to stay secure. And the sex instinct, without it, we would do nothing to reproduce and to procreate society. Those three instincts. Yet, he says, these instincts, so necessary for our existence, often far exceed their proper functions. Powerfully, blindly, many times subtly, they drive us, dominate us, and insist upon ruling our lives. Our desires for sex, for material and emotional security, and for an important place in society often tyrannize us. When thus out of joint, man's natural desires cause him great trouble. Practically all the trouble there is. No human being, however good, is exempt from these troubles. Nearly every serious emotional problem can be seen as a case of misdirected instinct. When that happens, our great natural assets, the instincts, have turned into physical and mental liabilities. Now remember what he's talking about here. He's not talking about our proper use of the instincts. He's talking about because of self-will. He's not talking about the proper use of the instincts as he designed them to be used. He's talking about the out-of-limits manifestation of these instincts because of self-will, because I apply self-will to them and I get them beyond God's intended limits. That's what we're going to talk about. If you go to your next handout, the basic instincts, Jerry's going to work on these with us.
Okay. This is a basic instincts chart up here that we've got, and we've broken it down into social instinct, security instinct, and sex instinct. And these are the three major categories that self-will manifests itself in, because we have the ability to do things in these three areas that animals don't. All animals have the same instincts that we do. They have all of the same instincts that we do. They have the instinct for the social instinct. That's why birds flock, cattle herd, fish school. You know, they have a social instinct, but they don't have a clue why they're doing it. But the reason they do that at God's direction. That's the very one reason they do it. All animals have a security instinct. You know, they want to be secure in the future. You see little squirrels in the fall of the year, he'll be running around putting nuts in a hole. And he doesn't have a clue why he's doing that. But he's doing it at God's direction. Because in every animal except man, all of these instincts are directed by God. They do it all. The sex instinct in animals. Normally when in sexual situations in animal life, there's normally some chemical change in the female and they sense it. And they go ahead and they have sex and they reproduce like they're supposed to do. And they're doing it all at God's direction. Because like cows, you know, when the time comes, they go ahead and do it, and they get on with it, and they go out and start eating grass and doing their own thing. They're not thinking about it before they do it. They're not thinking about it while they do it, and they're not dreaming about it after they do it. They're just...
Hopefully.
They're just doing their thing, and everything on in this world is doing exactly what God intended for it to do. Except us. And we have the ability to take this thing out of limits. Okay, let's go over here and look at our social instincts. All of us have a need for companionship. And when we're growing up in society, you know, society changes from location to location. And as we're growing up in the environment that we're raised in, we are taught, society will teach us what we know and what we need to do in order to be accepted where we are growing up. You know, it'll tell us what we need to be. And so, in some places, it may be a large piece of land. In some places, it might be a good education. In some places, it might mean you got 14 rocks. You know, it depends on society, but society will teach us what we need to do in order to be accepted in society. And all of us want to be accepted. Some of us want the prestige of being recognized as a leader and all this stuff. And the society will teach us what we need to do in order to get that. Say, if your social instinct tells you when you're growing up, says, do you know, if I get to a nice college and get a good degree, I am really going to be accepted in my community. People are going to look up to me. I can join my church. The people in the community, I am going to become an integral part of this community, and I'm going to be well respected, and everything's going to be great. So you work really hard. You set goals for yourself, because you can't sit on your duff and be accepted. You know, you got to do some things. So we set goals for ourselves, and we work and we work and we work and we work, and we accomplish these goals. And it feels absolutely wonderful when we do this. You know, if you, you have massive parties when kids graduate from college. You know, and it's great. And you say, man, I've got this degree and I'm just doing so good. And then all of a sudden, that lasts about 38 minutes. And then you start looking around and you say, I've got a bachelor's degree. And so-and-so over there has got a master's degree. And his school is more prestigious than mine. So if I'm going to be accepted in this crowd, I've got to do some more stuff. So we set even greater goals for ourselves, and we work really hard, and we manage well, and we sacrifice, and we do the things, and we reach other goals. And then at the culmination of these, it's really great for about 14 minutes. And then you start looking around. It's like always, man is never satisfied. He's never, you know, we have this ability to do these things at our pace, and we get all caught up in it. And when self starts injecting itself in there, we get into all sorts of trouble. Because if I'm making goals and I'm doing things and I'm working really hard, all of a sudden I'm going to discover one day that I'm not getting things as rapidly as I think I need to. So what I start doing is I start taking a few shortcuts. I'll cheat a little bit, steal a little bit, and lie a little bit in order to get things that I feel like I deserve. Then I'm gonna take some liberties over here that I really shouldn't take. And it's going to hurt people whose lives are, who are in my life. I'm going to hurt them, and they are going to retaliate, and they are going to make my life miserable because I've made their life miserable. And I am going to come to understand over here that any life run on self-will can never be a success. Never be a success.
Because okay? it's going to generate some resentments. Going to generate some fears.
Absolutely.
And there's going to be some shame, guilt, and remorse from the harms that I'm doing to other people. No life can be a success run on self-will. No, Ron. If you take your glasses, I think you're bouncing off your glasses into
your
microphone.
Oh, is that what I'm
doing? There you go, Jerry.
Oh,
that
okay.
May not be it. But
it very well may be because I don't sound as bad. Okay, the security instinct. Security instinct up here in the middle of the thing. You know, animals have this, and we've talked about this, and we all have security instincts. We would all like to be secure, and now and in the future. And society teaches us what we need to do in these areas too. And like I say, it could be a college education. It could be a big piece of land. It could be a large family. It could be anything that would make you secure. Like when I grew up on the farm out in the country, people had large families because that was cheap labor. You know, all you had to do was feed them. And that helped with the security instinct if people had a lot of family. But if you have these material needs and these needs for security, both emotional and material, and you start setting goals for yourself and you work really hard to get those goals, you know, it may be paying off your mortgage on your house. You ever heard of people have a big party and have a mortgage burning when they pay off their house? They've reached these goals and it's wonderful for 2.5 hours till the barbecue grill goes out. They have the mortgage burning and then the guy starts looking around and he said, "My Lord, his house is bigger than my house. Besides that, his car is 3 years newer than mine. And he wears Brooks Brothers suits and I have to get my clothes at Walmart." You know, and we're not satisfied with that, so we set new goals and we do the same identical thing in the security instincts that we did over here in the social instincts. We start making new plans, setting new goals, work real hard to get there, and if we're not getting these things as rapidly as we think we should, then we start taking shortcuts. We lie, and we cheat, and we step on people's toes, and we do bad things and upset them. They retaliate and make our life miserable, and we have to understand that no life, anybody's life run on self-will, will never, ever be a success. Okay? Because it creates these things down here, resentments, all this fear and all this harms and hurts that we do to other people, the shame, guilt, and remorse. And the sex instinct, society will teach us growing up what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. And we will set goals and we may work real hard to try to do this. And we get married, say, and we have an acceptable sex life. And then everything's rocking along pretty good for a little while. And then self will inject itself in there. And say, "You know, John's wife is 2 years younger than mine. And besides, she's a size 8, and my wife is a 12. And she's larger in certain places than my wife is. and you become dissatisfied. And then, in the sexual area, you start taking shortcuts. And if you don't watch yourself in this area, and I'll tell you one thing about the sexual area, we have the ability to hurt more people in a shorter span of time in this area than any other way I can think of. You can do one careless act in this area, and you can devastate 15 people in 10 minutes in the sexual area. It's very volatile. But we have the ability to do this, and if we don't watch ourselves, when we get to this disgruntled stage where we're not getting what we want when we think we ought to have it, like we did over here in these two areas, we're going to start stepping on some people's toes, and we're going to start hurting other people. And what we're going to do is we're going to wind up, we're going to be having sex with the wrong people at the wrong time, at the wrong place, and we're going to hurt a bunch of people, and they're going to retaliate and make our life totally miserable. And we're going to understand once more that any life run on self-will can never, ever be a success. You know, all of this self-will, that is God-given. It's great. But when we do take these things out of the bounds that God intended for them to, they do become our worst ever liabilities. Stick another chart up there, Dick, and I'll do that, and then you can come back to this one.
This is Jerry's personal chart. He likes this.
Oh, I love this chart. Golly, Pete, I love it.
Don't get the idea now that that God didn't intend for the sex instinct to be strong or any of these. He intended for these to be important, as Jerry said. He intended in the sex area for sex to be used for two purposes, procreation and enjoyment. And he wants us to use sex in that way, procreation and enjoyment. And we have a little trouble keeping it within those bounds. He wants the material security instinct to keep within its limits. He wants the social instinct to stay within its limit. It's because of self-will that I take it outside of God's intended limits. And that's what gets me in trouble, because that's where I begin to step on people's toes and hurt other people, and they retaliate, and I got resentments and fear and shame, guilt, and remorse.
Is that not just a neat-looking chart, folks? Okay. This is the trouble that all of mankind gets into all the time. This is the reason, this is the ability that we have that separates us from animals. You've never seen a cow on a psychiatrist's couch. They do not have the ability to get in trouble like we do. And this ability that we have to destroy our lives and the lives of others is because of self-will. Okay, let's look at what these three areas that we've been talking about, social and security and the sex instinct, basic instincts of man. Now, these things in other animals and in some people who don't exercise their self-will, these are God-directed. And when they are, this is what happens. I'll give you an example of these instincts over here. See, they're level across the top and everything's in pretty much harmony over here. This guy says, you know, if I get a nice college degree, engineering degree, there's a good demand for engineers, I'm going to be accepted in my community and I'm going to do all right. So he sets his goals and he goes and he gets his degree. And about this time he's getting this degree, his security instinct comes in over here and says, you know, if you were to take this degree to some of these Fortune 500 companies that really need the engineers, said if you would hold out, you know, for a nice employment package, you would be secure, and said maybe we could get us a little house with a nice picket fence, and everybody over here in the social area is going to like you, and the security area, you're going to have a nice job, have a 401k, everything's going to be great. So he does this, and he sets goals, and he gets hired by a nice company, and he buys him a little house, and he is very accepted in the community, nice guy, has a good job, and all of this. Sex instinct raises its ugly head and said, you know, there's a neat little girl that works down at the bank, and said, if you would just act right, get you some decent looking clothes, go down there, you may can date her. And said, everything might be all right. So he goes down and he makes a move at the girl on the bank. Nice girl, takes her out a few times, they enjoy each other's company, and they hit it off right together. 3 months, 4 months, 6 months later, they're married. So now what have we got here? We've got a nice guy with a good degree. He's got a nice job. He's got a nice wife who works down at the bank, supplying a little extra income. They got this nice little house. Everything is in order. None of these instincts are in conflict with any of the rest of them. See, they're all the same link right here on the top. All these are God-directed instincts. And a result of these instincts are peace of mind, serenity, and harmony. And we can be sober, happy, and free when our instincts are over here like this. Now, when we decide to exercise one of our basic instincts out of bounds, let's see what happens. Okay? Somebody tell me which one you want to be out of bounds. Which instinct do you want to be out of bounds?
Every time.
You never fail us.
Everybody always wants the same one.
You know, I've been doing this for almost 10 years. I've never done security in my life. Okay. We see what happens over here to us when we are God-directed and we're doing things and they're happy, joyous, and free over here. This sex instinct over here gets out of bounds. This guy over here, his wife sends him to the grocery store one afternoon to get a gallon of milk. And there's a little girl at the checkout counter, and he looks over at her and says, "Honey, you look really good." And she says, "You do too." Said, "Why don't we meet down at the Y'all Come Back Motel tonight, and we'll talk this thing over." And they make this appointment to go to the Y'all Come Back. And you know what happens? Let me tell you what happens. First of all, peace of mind goes right out the stinking window. You know, this cat ain't even done nothing yet, and he's a bundle of nerves. He's looking in his rearview mirror wondering if anybody's following him since he talked to the girl. And if he does go to the motel, he's going to say, "My Lord, what if somebody sees my car?" He is going to be a basket case before he ever does anything. And you know what his social instinct over here is going to say? What in the world are the people going to think about you if they catch you in the Y'all Come Back Motel with this gal you don't even know? What are people in the community going to think about you? Your social instinct is going to be bankrupt down here. Your security instinct is going to look up and say, "You idiot, what do you think is going to happen if your wife catches you down there? She's going to get all your money. She's going to get the house. The people in the community are going to hate you. So what you've done..."
Probably going to get fired.
Yeah. You have indulged one instinct out of bounds that God intended for it to be, and you have devastated these other two. See, that's what sets up... Dr. Siltworth says we are irritable, restless, and discontented. Now, do you see what causes that? That because when we exercise one of these instincts out of bounds, we always do it at the expense of the other two. And we set up this internal conflict, which makes it, we're always irritable, restless, and discontented. Because this part is rejoicing and these other two parts of us are in really terrible shape. We do this and we are directed by self-will. We are full of resentment. We're full of fear. We're doing things to harm other people. We're blocked off from God. We're blocked off from other people. But I hate being blocked off from God, but this is almost as bad, is that internal conflict. We're irritable, restless, and discontented. Now do we see by this chart why any life run on self-will can never be a success? If we do this, the only thing we're doing is asking for trouble. Okay.
Selfish and self-centered people will always, their lives will always be manifested in resentments, fear, and shame, guilt, and remorse from the harm that they're doing other people. If somebody comes up to you that you're sponsoring or you know, and they said, "You think I'm selfish or self-centered," say, "Let me ask you three questions. Are you mad all the time? Are you scared to death all the time? Are you doing things that harm other people? And if they're selfish and self-centered, they'll tell you yes to some of those at least. And so you can answer them and say, so I suspect you're selfish and self-centered, because all of those things manifest themselves in those areas. Now, if we've made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, we ask Him to direct our will and do our thinking, and we can't do this when our mind is still occupied by these resentments and these fears and the shame, guilt, and remorse of the harm done to other people. Now, I want you to go to the next two handouts, the next handout, and we're going to... These, again, every once in a while we use some things that Joe and Charlie don't use, and we've added some things today that Joe and Charlie don't use. But just to make a point again about what we're talking about here, how important it is, how important Bill understood it was, that I come to grips with the selfishness and self-centeredness and how it dominates my life, because I cannot move ahead, cannot make a decision until I understand the importance of being rid of selfishness and self-centeredness. And to see how this works, here's the balanced personality that God expects us to have with Him in the center. There's nothing wrong with this personality. It's balanced. Let me tell you how it's balanced. He expects us to have some resentment. Now, you and I think that resentment is all bad, but it's not. Resentment sponsors, motivates invention and doing things that that are wise to keep up. National defense. A lot of that is a result of resentment and some of the things that we do that are important. So resentment is okay within limits. And that includes self-resentment. Resentment and self-resentment are the same. And we have to deal with them the same way. God gives us some qualities which help me keep that within limits. The qualities of love and tolerance and patience and self-restraint and reasoning help me keep the resentment and self-resentment within limits. God wants me to keep them within limits. Resentment. Let me tell you about some good resentment. When I lived in Stone Mountain, I lived on a little cul-de-sac, and there were only four or five houses on the cul-de-sac, and two houses down was a guy by the name of Dick Formanti. And Formanti lived there two houses down from me. And I'm going to show you about good resentment. If I'm sitting up in front of my garage or on my porch, and I look down and I see Dick Formanti getting out his ladders and his paintbrushes and a few gallons of paint and some claw, drip claws and stuff, I say, Formanti's going to paint his house. And when he gets through painting it, it's going to look better than mine. I can do something about that. And so I run over to the Duron store or the DeVoe store or Sherwin-Williams store, and I get me 7-8 gallons of semi-transparent stain and some trim paint, and I come back, and I get my brushes out and my ladders out, and while Formanti's painting his house, I paint mine. And when we get done, both of us are better off, and both of our houses look good. You see, I had a resentment that his house was going to look better than mine. Little cul-de-sac, not many houses to compare. And I took action based on that resentment, and I kept it within limits. I showed love and tolerance and patience and self-restraint and reasoning. Helped me keep it within limits. The fear instinct. God intends for us to have some fear. It keeps us from jumping off tall buildings, walking out in front of cars, trains, buses, and things of that nature. It keeps us from doing dumb things. It helps us establish things for our future life without thinking about cashing in on them. And things of this nature. Tends for us to have some fear. And He gives me some qualities to help me offset that. Some courage and some faith. To keep those fears within reason. Normal fears with God intended for us to have. He intended for me to have a sex instinct and to operate in the sex instinct. And again, for procreation and enjoyment. Perfectly right. How do I keep that within God's limit? With the qualities which help me offset it. Wisdom. Ain't always used it. Ain't always had it. Prudence. Not always used that.
Sorry to say that. Logic and unselfishness.